Many of you will know that last May I traveled to Israel for my first ever trip to the Holy Land. Our first 4 days there were spent in the north in Galilee, and that sojourn included a visit to New Testament Bethsaida, just north of the Sea of Galilee. It is in Bethsaida that Jesus called several of his disciples. Bethsaida is one of those fishing villages in which Jesus spent considerable time. But Bethsaida was not always a small hamlet. 1,000 years prior to Jesus' life, in the time of David, Bethsaida was the capital of the kingdom of Geshur. It was to Geshur that the young David traveled to find a wife. It was to Geshur that David's son Absalom fled after he had murdered his brother Amnon. Well, Bethsaida today is the site of a major archaeological dig, and the findings there are amazing. With my colleagues, I walked along the stone pavers of an uncovered road upon which Jesus himself trod. But most striking of all is the main gate, not to Jesus' Bethsaida, but to the more ancient Davidic era city, when Bethsaida was Geshur's capital city, when it was a walled fortress of a place rather than a fishing village. And that gate, it's actually a fortress all its own. It encompasses a series of granaries protected by enormous walls that are 6 meters thick, by far the strongest, most monumental walls in all of the ancient world. Those walls are so thick as to be conspicuous, in fact. Talking about the ancient inhabitants of Bethsaida, archaeologist Kate Raphael says this: "The feeling you get is that the inhabitants of the city were either terrified of something on the outside or were protecting something really valuable on the inside." Well, I thought about those Bethsaida ruins again this week when I reread for the 1,000th time the parable of the rich fool, as it is known, which we just heard in Luke's gospel. This is a parable about greed. Indeed, the precipitating warning for this parable has Jesus saying explicitly today, quote, "Be on your guard against all kinds of greed." And then he tells the parable. But in what exactly does greed consist? Well, in our era, greed is most often identified, I think, with our capitalist economic system. In the 1980s, after all, the despicable movie character Gordon Gekko famously declared in the Hollywood film Wall Street that greed is good. Well, Gordon Gekko was a caricatured image of an unscrupulous Wall Street raider. But as so often happens, over time, the caricature was assumed to be capitalism's real-life definitive norm, and capitalism itself was equated with greed. But that's unfortunate for many reasons, and most especially because that caricature contributes to attacks on what's really a paper tiger that doesn't conform to reality, if we're honest. Is capitalism just greed in the aggregate? Is it merely a vehicle for vampires looking for prey? No. According to a recent study reported in The Economist magazine, in the last decade alone, world poverty was reduced by more than 50%, by more than half. And the drivers of that reduction, revealed in the specific places on the globe where poverty decreased, the drivers in that reduction of poverty by more than 50% were open capitalistic markets. Now, I'm obviously trained as a theologian and a priest, not an economist. I have personal amateur opinions on appropriate market regulation and important consumer protections and the like, but that's for coffee hour conversation, not the pulpit. From a theological point of view, I'll simply say that overall, an economic system that lifts in a decade half of the world's impoverished people from misery closer to sustainable living is a virtue. It's something we should hone, but it's also something we should cherish. And it can't be, I think, it can't be what Jesus is decrying in today's parable. But what then is greed all about from Jesus' point of view? Well, the key is in the event that immediately precedes today's parable. A man approaches Jesus and says, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." Well, any priest or any family lawyer knows immediately the background of this request, because it is our lot often to be in the middle of just such disputes. What has happened prior to this request is so common then as now as to be tragically mundane. There are siblings. There are family possessions, things. And the desire for those things has taken precedence over the relationship between the siblings. The man who approaches Jesus wants his inheritance more than he wants a relationship with his brother. He's willing to sacrifice the latter for the former. He craves the tangible, the finite, the things that he can have and hold and possess, the material wealth that he can pretend imputes intrinsic value to him. He craves this more than he values continuing community with those that he has loved. And that is greed. Whether it's in an economic system or a person, whether it's in a society or an individual. Listen, friends, to this definition. Greed is the desire for anything so intense that it comes to believe its object is of greater value than human relationships. That's worth hearing again. Greed is the desire for anything so intense that it comes to believe its object is of greater value than human relationships. Now, with that definition, it may be obvious that greed need not be directed only toward material things. Greed can be the desire for physical or emotional protection. Greed can be the craving for acclaim or esteem. Greed can be the gnawing need for attention or pity. The objects of greed are infinitely varied. But in every instance, greed is defined when the desire for its object takes precedence over relationships. When desire concludes that community with others is disposable. So long as greed obtains its object, relationships are always sacrificed on the altar of greed. How does God respond to human greed in all of its forms? Fools, God says today in Jesus' parable, without pulling punches, No object in this world, tangible or intangible, has that kind of value. The things we desire in this world are, like this world itself, ephemeral. They don't feed the soul. They don't, when hoarded and held like fetishes, give life either to the bearer or to the world. And those silos, those walls that we build to hold the physical and emotional objects of our greed only make us hard and cold and suspicious and mean. They don't protect us. And ultimately, as Jesus says unequivocally today, our greed, our silos, our walls sacrifice even our relationship with God. You see, greed is an addiction. Make no mistake. And as with any other addiction, its cravings grow with time. Ultimately, the objects of greed become, as St. Paul says in Colossians today, idols. And the very emotional and psychological and physical silos that we build with the pretense of protecting those idols instead simply separate us from our brothers and our sisters and our friends and our God. The end game of our greed is that we eventually stand emotionally, psychologically, existentially, and often physically alone. In today's epistle reading, St. Paul responds to a community in which the danger of greed, of that relation-sacrificing desire, is very present. But Paul is an apostle of hope, and he doesn't merely diagnose the problem, he also prescribes the treatment. To the Colossians, Paul exhorts, "Put greed to death." And he adds that we must also let go of all those byproducts of our greed, those things that flow from our cravings and serve as the actual weapons that kill our relationships. Anger and malice and slander and abusive language. In a word, Paul says that we must change. But how do we do that? Well, if our epistle reading went just a few verses further, we'd see. Listen to what Paul says there. Quote, "Clothe yourself with compassion, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience. Bear with one another. And above all, clothe yourselves with love, which binds everything together in perfect harmony. And let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts. And be thankful. Bear with one another. And clothe yourselves with love." See, that prescription requires no object at all. Nothing into which greed can latch its teeth. It requires only the very thing that greed denies, the primacy of relationships of love with all those round about us. It requires the effort and vulnerability and risk to put intimacy in first place. To embrace the humanity of friends and strangers. To recognize the present love of God that binds us all together. And in light of all these things, to pause. and be thankful at those Bethsaida ruins north of the Sea of Galilee. Those enormous granary walls are not the only conspicuous things that have been discovered. There's also evidence around the base of those walls of fiery destruction. Arrowheads, spear points, slingshots that bear silent witness to a fierce battle that took place when those city gates were breached and those walls were put to the torch. Those massive walls, all 6 meters thick, did not in the end protect those within. They did not preserve their objects. They ultimately failed. Those walls, it turned out, weren't permanent, nor was the grain they held. The things of this world never are. We can wait for our silos and our walls to fall down around us, leaving us alone in their ruins. Or we can dismantle them ourselves with God's grace, letting go of the objects of our greed, and we all have them, in favor of human relationships of risk and vulnerability, giving up our various idols in favor of love for God and one another. We can exhaust ourselves building walls, or we can clothe ourselves with love, bearing with one another, both here and out there, in kindness and compassion. When we do the latter, craving will cease. And the peace of Christ will rule in our hearts. And we will truly be thankful. Amen.